Case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Baker against General Motors. Mr. Rawson, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court. Appellants are non-striking General Motors employees who were laid off due to strikes elsewhere. It's agreed that the only basis for the labor dispute disqualification in this case was because they paid emergency dues. The issue is, may a state deny unemployment compensation to these appellants solely because they paid emergency or increased dues lawfully required as a condition of remaining union members, where the dues were for the union strike fund from which strikers later received strike benefits? Appellants' union at a convention in October voted to require as a condition of membership emergency dues of all UAW members in the United States and Canada. And it is agreed and stipulated that these appellants paid $20 to $40 each for the months of October and November 1967 to their own local unions, which then sent these increased or emergency dues to the International Union's strike fund. Appellants continued working at their own plants. Their local unions settled their contracts, which appellants ratified. That year, there was no national strike at General Motors Corporation. Instead, the General Motors agreement was settled in December and ratified by the union members. In late January, three General Motors foundry locals went on strike over local issues, and after those 11 to 12 day strikes ended, they received no more than $18 from the International Union Strike Fund. Those foundry strikes caused part shortages and resulted in layoffs at appellants' plants. Appellants were comparatively few members at each plant who were selected because they had lower seniority, and they were laid off from those plants by General Motors. And they applied for unemployment compensation for that February, 3 months after they paid those dues. They were found eligible under state law in the sense that they had worked long enough to earn their compensation, they had enough credit weeks, they were available for work, they were seeking work, they wanted to continue working, but they were involuntarily unemployed. The labor dispute disqualification was asserted as a reason for denying them compensation, and under all aspects or all parts of the Michigan labor dispute statute, they were not disqualified except one. And what we mean by that is that they were held by all agencies and courts to not be in the same locations as the strikers. They were not participating in any foundry strikes. They were not interested in them in the sense that they could not benefit from them, nor could they influence those negotiations or strikes. They were disqualified because they had financed the labor dispute as held by the Michigan court because they had paid those increased or emergency dues the previous October. If possible, we'd like to get into our argument a little bit and then try to respond to some of the points made by General Motors. It's pretty well agreed that appellants would not have been disqualified from their unemployment compensation but for the fact that they chose to remain union members and paid these increased or emergency dues. The Michigan Supreme Court correctly held that this conflicts with their Section 7 right to assist their union, and it also conflicts with their rights to join and remain union members if they choose to do so. Under this Court's ordinary preemption rules, the state action which conflicts with such Section 7 rights would be preempted and wouldn't stand unless Congress affirmatively intended to allow such a conflict. And
Mr. Rawson, did any workers refuse to pay these increased dues?
It's stipulated, Justice O'Connor, at page 173 of the record, that all claimants paid these dues, these emergency dues, in accordance with the UAW Constitution. Thus, there is no evidence that anyone refused to pay the dues.
What would the union do with a member who refused to pay the increased dues for the purposes of financing a strike?
There is no evidence that the union took any action against any of the members in terms of trying to get someone's job or anything else under Section 8A3. The dues, it is our position that the dues were lawfully required dues under the union constitution, and in fact it stipulated and found that they were paid under the union constitution, and thus they were required to be union members. So failure to pay those dues based on those stipulations would jeopardize a person's union membership if he refused or she refused to pay those dues.
You concede that the state can disqualify non-strikers who finance a strike by means of payments other than in the form of union dues?
Below and in this court, we have not asked that the Michigan financing disqualification or provision be stricken.
Pardon?
On its face, that's right.
It can apply if it's payments other than union dues?
We concede that it can apply and be used as a disqualification when it is not based on the exercise of someone's Section 7 rights.
I don't think that answers the question. That really doesn't answer the question because, in effect, it would be an exercise of a Section 7 right to finance a strike, wouldn't it?
Well, it may or may not, Justice Stevens. For example, there are situations where an individual might send money if there's an existing strike, and that individual could do it alone. That individual may or may not be a union member, and that might be used as a basis for disqualifying someone for financing, and it would not involve the exercise of Section 7 rights.
Now, what if you did not? Well, I'm still not sure of your answer to Justice O'Connor's question is why I'm following up. What if they had just sent out a special assessment for the purpose of financing a strike? And then as a byproduct of that strike, these people were laid off temporarily. What would your position be?
Well, our position, first of all, is that that's not what happened here.
It's a different case, I understand.
But I didn't want there to be any misunderstanding in that score. But if the union did that and all the money was going to the strikers,
well, it goes into a large fund, and the fund, in turn, is used to support the
particular
strike.
I was going to say, if the money was going to the strikers and the union is a mere collection agent, I'm not sure that it makes a difference if it's labeled dues or not. And I'm not sure that would really involve assisting the union, even though the union's a collection agent, any more if a union collects money for the United Fund and sends it to someone. But if the money goes into a large pot, then I think into the union's strike fund, even though, unlike this case, there is an existing strike at the time, then I think the case would be very much like General Motors versus Bowling, which was decided by the Illinois Supreme Court. And the Illinois Supreme Court there said that because the union was really deciding how this money was going to be paid, and the union would decide when to pay it and how much and to whom, and it was not these dues. And there were people in the same plant paying dues, increased dues, double dues. The Illinois Supreme Court said that it would not interpret financing under its statute to apply to those payments because they were dues, and the union really was deciding how to pay them. Now, that is different from a situation where the payer knows that 100% of the money paid is going to merely, even if it goes into a pot, is going to be sent to people on the existing strike. But we think the Bowling situation, the example that I gave there, it is our position that that would be preempted. Even though we believe our case is a much stronger case for preemption, we believe that there also would be preemption in that case, and that Congress did not intend in the National Labor Relations Act or the Social Security Act to disqualify anyone for financing, let alone for paying dues. Did that get closer? Is it? No? In terms of the legislative history, the National Labor Relations Act does not provide any guidance as to congressional intent in this case. And in 1935, when the Social Security Act was passed, there was no financing provision in any state labor dispute statute. So for that reason, you cannot say, unlike in New York Telephone, for example, where there was an existing statute that Congress perhaps was aware of, you cannot say that Congress is aware of any financing provision in 1935. Now, the state of Michigan relies on 1936 action by the Social Security Board. After the Social Security Act was passed, where the Social Security Board recommended changing the disqualification of everyone in a struck establishment to only apply to situations where people participate, finance, or are directly interested in those disputes within that establishment. But in 1940, the Social Security Board, aware of a few applications by state agencies, not courts, recommended eliminating any financing provisions in these statutes because, as the Social Security Board said, it might be used to disqualify people solely for payment of dues. Now, in 1943, Congress indicated its awareness of the Social Security Board action because it changed the District of Columbia statute to do as suggested in 1936 by adding participating and directly interested. But it specifically omitted the financing provision. And since 1935, no state court, until this Michigan court, has ever disqualified anyone under a financing provision for solely paying union dues. Now, what we mean by that, when we say for solely paying union dues, we mean in other cases where dues may have been involved, the people were also in the same establishment as the strikers. They were also held to be interested in the strike financially, and they were also held to be participating. So there is no pure dues holding in unemployment insurance history in the United States by a court until this one. And there is, and this gets me a little bit back to Justice Stevens' question. There's something else that's also fluky about this Michigan decision. The financing provisions came out of English law, and they were aimed at situations where people in a factory were striking, and other people, knowing of those strikes, sent money to those strikers, which then caused their own layoffs. In every other financing decision in the United States, including agencies, whether or not they involve dues, they all involve the same situation of an existing strike that people were sending money to. And we mention this because it emphasizes the unusual quality and nature of the Michigan decision, which makes it, in our opinion, unusual as what Florida did in Nash, where Florida was the only state to interpret its labor dispute disqualification in a bizarre way. And yet this court, despite the fact that that was unusual, did not allow Florida to punish that worker because she exercised statutory rights. General Motors relies on this court's decision in New York Telephone and says that because Congress, as you indicated, New York Telephone was apparently aware of a state statute which paid benefits to strikers after disqualification and also disqualified strikers, that therefore it should be assumed that Congress also intended to permit disqualifying anyone else in who exercises other Section 7 rights wherever there's a strike. But as your honors know, New York Telephone rested on awareness by Congress of a specific statute which did that. And as we have shown, there was no statute in existence in 1935 that did what happened to these people. And the fact that Congress was aware that a state may impede the right to strike does not mean that Congress intended or should be implied to permit a state to impede all other Section 7 rights, or rather, or all other NLRA rights. And certainly Nash is an example of that holding. And General Motors concedes in its brief that the state could not disqualify persons because they're union members. So there are situations where a state's labor dispute disqualification has been limited. And striking, for NLRA purposes and for unemployment insurance purposes, is different than other Section 7 rights, particularly the rights of free association. Strikers leave work, and things can happen to them under the NLRA that economically disadvantage them. General Motors could have replaced the foundry strikers if it had wished, permanently replaced them. But General Motors could not have punished these appellants because they chose to pay these dues, even if there was a foundry strike in existence at the time, and even if some of those dues reached those foundry strikers. General Motors could not have laid them off because they paid these dues. And yet, General Motors is asking this court, as it did Michigan, to punish these claimants because they paid these dues.
They're withholding some state benefits, I suppose, that they would otherwise been qualified for.
Yes, they were eligible in every other respect, but for the fact that they were held disqualified for paying these emergency dues. So they had met all the other eligibility requirements. And
you say that burdens their Section 7 rights?
We do, and Michigan did too. The Michigan Supreme Court agreed with that much and held that there was a conflict. And this gets us close, I think, to what this court did yesterday in Golden State. We are not asking Michigan to pay benefits to these appellants because they paid their union dues. We're asking Michigan to pay benefits to these appellants because they were laid off and forced out of work. And yet General Motors is asking Michigan to deny benefits to these appellants because they paid those dues. General Motors is asking the state to condition denial just on their paying dues, which they were required to pay to remain members. And this court, every justice of this court in recent cases has expressed concern for protecting Section 7 rights, particularly rights of employee self-organization, which we believe would include the right to remain union members and to pay these dues. And certainly, if you leave the right to resign unfettered, it seems to me that you should leave the right to remain unfettered also if people choose to remain union members and pay these dues. And we do think it burdens those rights.
Strikers out, too. That burdens their right to strike pretty much.
Yes. Employers are allowed to take action against strikers.
Without committing an unfair labor practice.
That's right. And they can replace strikers, as I indicated earlier. And state statutes state statutes regularly disqualify strikers from unemployment compensation, and they would have done
well,
that.
About,
actually.
So you wouldn't think that strikers that the state must pay unemployment benefits to strikers?
No.
Isn't that burdening Section 7 rights?
Yes, it does burden Section 7 rights to deny benefits to strikers.
So
of
why
course.
May the state do it?
The state may do it because, Your Honor held or said in New York Telephone, Congress intended to permit them to do it.
To either grant or deny them.
Exactly. To strikers.
Yes.
And strikers have not been treated the same or synonymously with dues payers.
But the strikers' claims when they're strikers, the claim still is that their Section 7 rights are being burdened by a refusal to pay unemployment benefits, just like the claim is here that these people who finance strikes are exercising their Section 7 rights.
And but for Congress's awareness, as indicated in New York Telephone, that might be considered improper, too. But strikers, even if there were no labor dispute disqualification, Justice White, strikers are different because they voluntarily leave their jobs. And Congress was probably aware that in 1935 that people who leave their jobs voluntarily generally don't get unemployment compensation, even if you had no labor dispute statute. I mean, it's a traditional unemployment insurance concept, as old as any unemployment insurance statute in history, that people who leave work are disqualified from unemployment compensation.
How did these people lose their jobs?
They were the low seniority people at their plants who were laid off by General Motors found when they wanted to continue working because there was a shortage of materials.
They weren't out of the jobs because they were on strike. They were out of their jobs for another reason.
Yes, that's right. They were out of their jobs. They were involuntarily out of work, laid off by General Motors because General Motors didn't have enough parts because of those foundry strikes. And General Motors chose to lay off these appellants, comparatively few appellants at each plant, which was a humane reaction in a way. Didn't lay off everyone. If possible, we'd like to reserve any further time for rebuttal. Thank you.
We'll resume at 1 o'clock, counsel, and not have you split your argument now. Mr. Nash, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. I'd like to briefly run over the facts again quickly in this case to put them in perspective from General Motors' point of view. Here, a special strike fund assessment or special dues was made of UAW members. Payments to be made in October and were made in October and November of 1967, increasing each member of the union's dues payments into that strike from $1.25 a month to from $10 to $20 a month for total increased payments by these individuals of from $20 to $40 in this case. These special dues were made in anticipation of strikes in the auto industry, including in anticipation of either national or local strikes at General Motors plants. and funds were being contributed to a special strike fund which would pay benefits not only to strikers but also to UAW members who might ultimately be laid off as a result of those strikes, who did not receive unemployment compensation benefits from the states in which they were laid off, so that the benefits in this fund are paid not only to strikers but also to those who are laid off as a result if they don't get unemployment compensation benefits. In January and February of 1968, what was anticipated indeed came to pass. Three General Motors foundries went out on strike, and as a result of a lack of products or parts being made by those foundries, a number of employees, including all the plaintiffs in this case, were laid off at other GM plants because of the strike of their GM brethren in those three foundries. They were denied, in this case, the plaintiffs were denied unemployment compensation benefits in the state of Michigan because they had financed the strike which resulted in their unemployment. The financing arrangement through these special dues payments were, as found by the Michigan Supreme Court, or did, as found by the Michigan Supreme Court, have a meaningful connection with the unemployment which resulted from these strikes, and as a consequence, they were denied unemployment compensation. One further fact.
Mr. Nash, could the state treat the payment of regular union dues as financing of a strike?
That's not the case we have here.
I know that.
That is a tougher case, but I think analytically and at least arguably, yes, they could. And indeed, I think there are 37 states whose statutes do, in fact, treat the payment of regular union dues as a disqualification for unemployment compensation benefits. The reason for that, a number of reasons for that, I think, and the reasons for that primarily, however, I believe, come from this Court's analysis of the unemployment compensation system and the National Labor Relations Act in New York Telephone. This Court, at least as I read the decision of all of the justices in New York Telephone, determined that that Congress, when it enacted the National Labor Relations Act, intended to leave the parties in a neutral position, management and labor, each to bear the full economic consequences of a strike. Employees wouldn't be paid wages, the employer wouldn't be able to run his business and would lose money. Each side would bear the full economic consequences.
Well, in your view, I take it, any local strike supported by a national union strike fund could that leads to some layoffs of non-strikers will justify denying the benefits to the non-strikers.
Whether it justifies or not in terms of how the state interprets its unemployment compensation statute is one matter. The question before this Court is, does the Constitution, does the National Labor Relations Act and the Social Security Act allow the states to so act?
Yeah, maybe the question is whether Congress authorized that.
Yes, I believe the answer to that question is yes, that Congress authorized that not only in terms of the National Labor Relations Act and the balance of power struck,
and
but more
what's
particularly.
What's the evidence that leads you to think Congress intended to go so far as the circumstances I described with regular dues?
Okay. As I say, that's a tougher case than ours. But as I see it, what Congress intended and what this Court found that Congress intended when it passed the National Labor Relations Act was that each party to a dispute bore the natural economic consequences of that, and that a state interferes with and is preempted in its actions by the National Labor Relations Act if it, in fact, shifts that economic burden or changes that economic burden in either one of two ways. Either it requires the employer to pay more, it costs the employer more to take a strike, or if what the state is doing cushions the impact of that strike upon employees. In New York Telephone, this Court, as I read the decisions, said that absent the Social Security Act, payment of benefits to strikers, unemployment benefits, would be preempted by the National Labor Relations Act because it does both those things. Employers contribute to an unemployment compensation fund. If that money is paid to the strikers, it not only cushions the impact of that strike on those strikers, but it also costs the employer an awful lot more to take that strike. The same is true in this particular case. If an employer is required to pay benefit, if the employer, through the State Unemployment Compensation Fund, is required to pay benefits to those laid off as a natural consequence of a strike, i.e., laid off in another plant, it costs the employer more in that to take that strike because it has to pay benefits to everybody that's laid off as a result of that strike. And particularly in this case, where the strike fund pays benefits not only to strikers, but also to those laid off as a result of the strike, unless those latter people receive unemployment compensation benefits, if the state of Michigan paid unemployment compensation benefits to employees in this case who financed the strike, the employer would have to pay for all of that. And in addition, the strike fund would not be diluted by that, thus giving additional economic power to all the people on strike because their strike fund would be bigger, bigger benefits could be paid over a longer period of time. So that the payment of benefits in this case has the same effect of conflicting with the policies of the National Labor Relations Act as did the payment of strike benefits to, or benefits to strikers in the New York telephone case. The court held in this case, however, that that conflict with the National Labor Relations Act is allowed and was intended to be allowed by Congress because Congress passed the Social Security Act, which granted to the states broad powers to structure their Social Security systems the way they wanted to structure them.
Were the strikes here in, of the foundry, at the foundry plants, over purely local issues?
I don't know that, but I'm assuming that they were, yes.
Because the national issues had already been resolved.
That's correct, although that is not necessarily true in local strikes, and it was not true in later, or at least from GM's perspective, was not true in later strikes at local plants.
So the non-striking workers were concerned about really didn't have any interest in those local issues, I take it.
That's correct in this sense. Well, they had an interest in the strike to the extent that any time their brethren are able to mount a strike, they have more solidarity and are able to produce benefits for them. They did not have a direct interest in the strike. Indeed, had they had a direct interest, we wouldn't be here on this issue today because the Michigan statute says that employees are disqualified from unemployment compensation benefits if they're laid off as a result of a strike in which they have a direct interest. So presumably they would have been denied benefits on that basis rather than on the basis of having financed the strike. But the impact really, on the economics, the economic impact is the same. The balance in this case is tipped against the employer and in favor of the employees exactly the same as it was in New York Telephone. And to reiterate, this court, however, found that even though that conflicted in New York Telephone with the National Labor Relations Act, the state was allowed to engage in that kind of conflict because the Congress had passed the Social Security Act, giving the states broad powers to structure their own their own unemployment compensation system the way they wanted to. And as a consequence of that, even though those payments in that case interfered with the strong policy of the National Labor Relations Act for a state to remain neutral, it was okay for the states to do it. The Congress had given to the states the right to make those calls and structure their own system. That's the way we come at this case looking at New York Telephone. The plaintiffs in this case come at it differently. They say that here the employer has interfered with the Section 7 right of employees to finance a strike. That's a Section 7 right, and as a consequence, you've got basically a Garmin preemption case, that a state can't act in such a way as to interfere with the Section 7 right. First of all, we don't see that the interference with the Section 7 right is critical at all. Indeed, in New York Telephone, as Mr. Justice White pointed out before the break, in New York Telephone, the state had denied unemployment compensation benefits, as every member of this court said they would have interfered with the quintessential Section 7 right, the right to strike. Indeed, that right is so important that Congress went to all the trouble to pass a Section 13 of the National Labor Relations Act to restate once again that was a protected right, something it has not done with the financing of strikes. So the fact that it interferes with the Section 7 right should not make a difference. In this particular case, the Section 7 right allegedly interfered with the right to finance a strike unemployment benefits to those people has the same economic impact, i.e., the shifting of the balance under the National Labor Relations Act, and the state ought to be able to do it.
When members strike and the state denies unemployment compensation, there is the same burden, I suppose, on Section 7 rights.
That's correct. You burden us.
But the reason it isn't an unfair labor practice isn't preempted is because of the neutrality argument, I suppose.
Correct. I don't know that you can really call it so much an interference with the Section 7 right. I prefer to look at it that that if there's a strike.
Well, it's no, it's a, what do you call it in this case? It's the same, whatever it is.
You bear the natural economic consequences of your actions. When you strike and go out, yes, I guess one might say, and probably you would say, by not paying them unemployment compensation benefits, you've interfered with their right to strike. But you really haven't. What you've really done is said to those people.
Interfering here at least with your right to contribute to the support of a union.
That's correct, but that's all part and parcel of the union bearing the natural economic consequences of its strike. In fact, when the employees go out on strike, and in this case it's a very carefully drawn issue, here employees of General Motors went out on strike and the state Supreme Court found that in fact the employees who were laid off and denied benefits here significantly contributed to their own unemployment because they contributed to a strike fund which allowed those people, which supported those people who went out on strike. That also comes close to what is consistent with what the Social Security Act intended when it said to the states, pass your own unemployment compensation system.
Did these people lose their jobs on account of the strike?
Yes.
There's no question about
it. No question. They were laid off because the foundries were struck by their fellow UAW members in a strike which they helped to finance by paying these special dues to a strike fund, and they were laid off because the parts coming out of the foundry weren't coming anymore because of the strike and there wasn't enough work for them.
Well,
in
I suppose if the foundry workers had struck and then the employer locked everybody out, what about the people who didn't strike but who were locked out, but who had been contributing to the union?
The state of Michigan, under its unemployment compensation statute, says that if an employer locks out employees, that does not disqualify them from unemployment comp. So in this case, they would have been paid their unemployment compensation had the employers locked them out, even though that interferes with the employer's ability to lock out.
But all they did, though, instead of locking out, they laid them off.
Well, they laid them off as a result of no
work. Well, because there was a strike.
That's correct. But a lockout, I think, we're a little afield, but a lockout really is normally defined by courts, labor board, and arbitrators as an act by an employer seeking to put pressure on a union to get the union to concede to the employer's position. Here, the employer wasn't putting any pressure on anybody. He just didn't have work, and he laid these people off, and whether the union and that plant ever conceded to his position on anything was irrelevant. The people would come back to work as soon as there was work for them. And it really is not in the context of a lockout, as this court looked at in American Ship and Brown.
Counsel, I assume that you join those who say that these are voluntary contributions that the union labor made. Voluntary, if they did make it, they lost their union membership and their job, but that's voluntary.
Well, in this particular case, they would not have lost their job. There was no union security.
Would they have
provision.
Lost the union membership?
They might have lost their union membership.
Didn't the Constitution say so?
The UAW's Constitution?
Yeah.
I'm not an expert on the UAW's Constitution, but I would assume, yes, they could have lost their membership.
So you consider that voluntary?
No. I don't know whether it's voluntary or not, but I don't know that that is relevant.
But for your argument.
No, I don't need it to be voluntary, and if I said that, I spoke too fast. No, it doesn't have to be voluntary. The payment of these special dues. In fact, they aren't being denied unemployment compensation benefits in this case because they paid emergency dues, because they exercised a Section 7 right. What the state of Michigan held was they're being denied unemployment compensation benefits because they contributed to their own unemployment. They contributed to their own unemployment. That's the key to the state of Michigan. Whether that's a Section 7 right or not is really irrelevant. And that really is the key. Well, it may be semantics in this court. It was not semantics in the state of Michigan. The state of Michigan determined that employees shall, in fact, be paid unemployment compensation benefits unless they contribute in some way to their own unemployment. They quit, they're fired for cause, a whole bunch of ways in which a person contributes to his or her own unemployment and thus is denied benefits. Had they gone out on strike, they would have contributed, obviously, to their own unemployment. Financing the strike, which resulted in their layoff in the view of the state of Michigan, and I think correctly so in the interpretation of its statute, constitutes a contribution by the employee to his own unemployment and results in the denial of unemployment benefits. These people then are eligible to receive benefits under the UAW strike fund, and really what we're talking about here is shifting the funding of the UAW strike fund, at least indirectly, from the UAW and its members to the employer, General Motors, in this case.
Would it have been an unfair labor practice for the employer to fire these people for having paid the special dues?
Yes, I think so. That's a Section 7 right to pay those dues, and the employer could not fire them.
Yes.
Correct. But that has — it seems to me that that doesn't get us very far in determining not whether or not a state program, which is intended to provide benefits to people who don't contribute to their own unemployment, has to provide benefits to
and
people
I suppose
who might contribute.
If he had fired them for paying the dues and while an unfair labor practice proceeding was going on, these people wanted unemployment benefits, they would have got them.
I don't know what the answer to that case is.
They
probably would have, because there they would have been unemployed as a result of their being fired rather than as a result of the strike. And so I guess
— on the other hand, they were contributing to the strike fund, and you can't say that they didn't contribute to their own unemployment.
Well, except that if you say that the reason they are now unemployed is because they were fired rather than because of the ongoing strike.
They were fired because they contributed.
Well, anyway, it's a tough case.
That's a tough case, and that's not our case. Yes, Your Honor. I think in that circumstance, they were fired illegally, and therefore they probably would get the unemployment benefits. And they certainly would be eligible for back pay in the National Labor Relations Board proceeding if they then made an offer to return to work. This case, however, is, and I'd like to stress at this point, is not a question, doesn't present the question which I think Jordan was really talking about earlier, of whether the state of Michigan correctly interpreted its statute, whether it went off on some whimsy, whether or not the way the state of Michigan interpreted its statute is inconsistent with the way the state of Illinois interpreted its statute. The whole question is, in this case, is the state of Michigan free under the Constitution of the United States to make the interpretation it made? Does that conflict with an act of Congress? And we submit it does not conflict, indeed is consistent with the National Labor Relations Act. It certainly is consistent with what the Social Security Act, in fact, allows the states to do. And under those circumstances, there is no basis for saying that this act is preempted by the National Labor Relations Act. Congress has told the states you can do this kind of thing in structuring your own unemployment compensation system. This Court has found that in the New York telephone case. And as a consequence, whether Michigan was right or wrong in the way it interpreted its statute, it has the constitutional right to be either right or wrong. And that's not the issue. The issue is, does the National Labor Relations Act and the Social Security Act allow the state of Michigan to do what they did? And the answer to that, we submit, is clearly yes.
Mr. Cohen.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, there is a strong national labor policy reiterated by this Court only yesterday against state interference with the collective bargaining process in a way that alters the economic balance between labor and management. One way to view this case is that it presents the question whether a state is permitted to honor that federal policy and deny unemployment compensation to employees who, the state found, had paid extraordinary emergency dues that foreseeably went to support a strike that foreseeably caused their own unemployment, or whether, as appellants suggest, the state is required to pay benefits because the financing activities are protected by Section 7 because they are labeled dues. The government, including the National Labor Relations Board, believe that Congress meant to leave the states free to deny benefits in this situation. We think New York Telephone clearly suggests that answer. There, after considering the legislative history, the Court ruled that states were free to deny benefits to persons engaged in the quintessential Section 7 activity, striking. There are, I think, only two distinctions between New York Telephone and this case. First, New York Telephone involved the question whether the state could pay benefits. This case involves what I think every member of the New York Telephone Court would have thought was the easier question, whether the state can deny benefits.
The payment of benefits didn't involve the interference with any protected rights, I gather.
The payment did not. The denial of benefits, Justice White, would have burdened the exercise of the Section 7 right to strike. And yet, I think it was an assumption, and appellants have conceded here today, that the state was at least at liberty to deny benefits in that situation.
Yes, yes. But nevertheless, the argument against paying them was that the state shouldn't upset this balance. That was the argument.
Yes, and we think that the same argument is applicable here to the payment of benefits to people who were found by the state to have been as closely allied to the actual strikers as these appellants were. We think, indeed, that neither the legislative history nor the logic of New York Telephone suggests any distinction. I want, first of all, to stress that appellants are just wrong when they imply that the legislative history of the Wagner Act and the Social Security Act in 1935 distinguishes in some way between actual strikers and people who finance a strike that leads to their own unemployment. There is no such distinction. There were, as the Court noted in New York Telephone, five state unemployment compensation statutes that predated the Wagner Act. None of those statutes had a special category for actual strikers. All of those statutes disqualified, or in the case of New York, delayed payments to, a class of people consisting of everyone who was put out of work because of a strike, strikers, financiers, and innocent bystanders. The draft statutes that were submitted to Congress while it was considering the Social Security Act contained a similarly broad disqualification, and when Congress, acting as the District of Columbia legislature, adopted an unemployment compensation statute for the District of Columbia in 1936, it disqualified such a broad class of people. Nor was there any distinction between strikers and financiers in the sample statute promulgated by the Social Security Board in January 1936. The Social Security Board, the agency created by the Act, disqualified persons participating in, financing, or directly interested in the strike that caused their unemployment.
Mr. Cohen, do you think it makes any difference whether the non-striking workers have a direct interest in the issues of the local strike?
I think that Michigan was entitled to decide, as its legislature and its courts have, that non-striking workers who pay extraordinary dues that can be expected to finance other people's local strikes under circumstances where it is foreseeable that that will cause layoffs in their own plants. Michigan is entitled to disqualify those people.
So you would employ a foreseeability standard.
Well, I think the state of Michigan employed a foreseeability standard. I think that Congress permitted them to do that.
And did Congress care whether it was foreseeable?
Well, I think that Congress should be assumed to have cared about the policy of non-state intervention in a labor dispute that is going on. And I think what Michigan did here was to find that these employees were sufficiently directly involved with the labor dispute that was going on, that payment of benefits to them could constitute intervention, which they were entitled to not to do.
Do you think that payment of regular dues could be financing, in Congress's view?
I want to agree with Mr. Nash that's not this case. Disagree with him to the extent of saying I think probably not. I think that the rationale that the purpose of Congress in the two statutes was to permit the states to decide what they wish to do in this specific on the specific question of providing assistance in the context of a labor dispute does not extend to a disqualification because of the payment of strike of regular dues.
It is an elusive distinction somewhat, though, isn't it?
Well, I think, as usual, there is a gray area. I think Michigan worked for 20 years to draw the line, and it drew a correct one. I think there is a distinction between a decision not to finance people who are directly involved in a particular labor dispute, to the extent that these were, and a decision to deny benefits to people who are union members or have paid regular dues because it happened that some of those dues found their way into the hands of strikers. Michigan was careful not to do that. Wanted to say a word about the question whether this action was voluntary. I think it is clear under, among other things, this Court's decision in the Hodery case and all of the legislative history that I recited, that voluntariness is not a requirement of the federal statute. That is, a state is not required to find that a worker is voluntarily unemployed before it may disqualify him. I also think that voluntariness is an elusive notion in the context of what are inherently collective activities in which individuals may feel subject to varying pressures. For example, the decision by an individual not to participate in a strike could well be a violation of union rules, subjecting him to some sort of discipline, but it is nevertheless clear, I think, that states may deny benefits to people engaged in the voluntary activity of striking. Thank you.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Russin?
A few things, Your Honor, if I may. Mr. Cohen may not think it important if it's voluntary, but Justice Ryan, in his opinion, for the three justices in the Michigan Court, said that it was necessary to find voluntariness before you disqualify people for financing.
Was that a construction of the Michigan law or a description of what the Congress had permitted?
Well, it was a construction of the Michigan law, not what Congress meant. And the reason I'm making the point, Justice Rehnquist, is that in order to find voluntariness of these appellants, Justice Ryan said that they will be presumed to have done this voluntarily if they paid these dues in accordance with the union's rules and constitution. So I think the whole thing is tied up, and it is not so much a question of whether the dues are regular or irregular. It's the question we say is whether the dues were required to maintain membership, whether they were proper under Landrum Griffin.
But in order to make it a proper part of the federal question that you've brought here, You have to show that Congress's tolerance of them, or whatever you want to say, would depend to some extent on their voluntariness. The fact that there may be an incorrect finding of fact under Michigan laws to voluntariness certainly wouldn't be something we would review.
Well, I'm definitely not re-arguing Hodari, Justice Rehnquist. I'm not saying that you cannot disqualify people in a labor dispute section under all circumstances. For example, the other two counsel talked about the single establishment situation of which Congress was aware in 1935, where you disqualified everyone in the establishment now who are laid off due to a labor dispute. That might mean disqualifying people even though they were involuntarily out of work. We agree that this could happen. But the difference is, in that situation, you disqualify union members and non-union members alike, and you don't base the disqualification on their exercise of any Section 7 right. You just disqualify everyone in the establishment. And Your Honor is held in Hodari. Whether or not that's fair, that is certainly lawful. And we don't quarrel with that decision. That does not involve Section 7 rights. The question, the United States didn't do it in its brief, but both counsel use what we call a countervailing machinist's argument and say that GM is hampered economically somehow by if you pay these non-strikers, and that therefore you should let Michigan impede their express Section 7 rights. The economic effect on GM's ability to conduct the foundry strikes does not justify impeding these Section 7 rights. When Congress provides for a Section 7 protected right, by definition, Congress also tolerates some implicit economic effect on the employer or someone else. So you can't say that this amounts to the type of congressional intent that this court found in New York telephone, where there was an express awareness of these things. And in fact, if you look at congressional intent, in 1935, the state statutes that were then in existence paid unemployment compensation to non-strikers at other locations who were laid off during strikes. So if there is any economic imbalance here, Congress was probably aware of it. I mean, traditionally, unemployment compensation is paid to people who are laid off due to other situations. When they say in response to Justice Marshall's question that somehow these claimants contributed to their unemployment, it's a little far-fetched, we think, to say that when they paid $40 in October 1967, this caused a shortage of castings at the foundries in January 1968. I don't think anyone, certainly there's no finding below to support that unusual theory, nor is there a finding below to support the GM's argument that these claimants were allied with the foundry workers. GM's economic balance argument is based on facts that don't exist here, and as Justice O'Connor, her questions indicate some concern about this. If these appellants had been in league with the foundry workers, closely allied with them, or had there been a national contract that was open that could possibly have benefited them, they would have been disqualified under other Michigan statute sections anyway. You wouldn't reach these issues here, and states generally take care of those concerns. Apart from the fact General Motors' argument is purely speculative, if you look at it at all, Michigan takes care of these things. Michigan avoids the economic imbalance problem that was in New York telephone by denying benefits to strikers. And that's a fairly effective way of avoiding it. They could pay strikers?
Couldn't they?
I'm not sure. Your Honor this court held in New York telephone that they could pay strikers after 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. The government argued in New York telephone that it would be such an outrage to pay strikers from the beginning, and the dissents pointed that out too, that I'm not sure what this court would do with a case involving a state that paid benefits from the first day to strikers. I really don't. The basis of the decision in New York Telephone was that Congress was aware of that specific New York statute.
So you think the policy of so-called neutrality is pretty strong?
Well, I don't think this case involves the affecting neutrality, certainly in any way that hurts General Motors, regardless of what you do. When you impede an express Section 7 right, not when you personally, but when the state does, that action is preempted unless you find congressional intent to permit it. And you don't even have to get to any questions of neutrality. Congress took care of the neutrality argument when it said in the NLRA preambles.
So what if a state just denies payments to strikers from the very first day?
That would be permitted because...
Well, that certainly reads on Section 7 rights.
It does, Your Honor. And
why can they do it?
They can do that
of this strong policy of neutrality.
No, that's not why they can
what
do
is
it.
It? What is it?
They can do it because this Court held that Congress intended to permit it.
Yeah.
Because Congress was aware in 1935 of statutes that did that expressly. The New York statute denied benefits to strikers for 8 weeks. Other statutes denied benefits to strikers from the beginning. And that's why...
Where was the evidence found in New York, the New York case, both in the NLRA and in the Social Security Act?
Well, this Court held that the NLRA didn't indicate that you could affect these rights one way or the other, but this Court looked to the Social Security Act, I believe, the fact that the New York statute in question was on the books at the time that Congress passed the Social Security Act in 1935. That's where this Court found there was congressional intent, or at least some of the justices.
Your time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Norris. I did that same thing that happened last week. I covered up the red light with my...
Gentlemen, the case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...